Today on Against the Grain, the focus group and consumer capitalism appear to go hand in hand. But Liza Featherstone argues that the focus group has radical origins and, in convoluted ways, points to the potential for collective input in an egalitarian society. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with her about the history of focus groups for consumer goods and electoral politics. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Democracy and consumerism both need the participation of ordinary people, but the former in the U.S. leaves much to be desired. My guest today argues that elites have to manage that contradiction, where the masses have limited social and political power in a market democracy, and one of the forms that management takes is the focus group. That's the subject of Liza Featherstone's latest work, Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation, published by Orr Books. Featherstone is a contributing editor at The Nation magazine, and her other books include Selling Women Short. Liza, who uses focus groups today, and who is typically called upon for their opinions?
So typically focus groups are used by any group of professionals who want to find out the opinions of the general public or the masses. And generally, it's a group of people that they're somewhat estranged from. So, you know, a bunch of advertising creatives in New York City, Democratic Party operatives, people who are in some way supposed to do the thinking of the ruling class or corporate America for them, but the consent of the average person is required, or the approval, or the votes, or the dollars, and therefore their opinion. Who's in the focus groups are average people. I mean, it was amazing to me when I participated in a lot of focus groups as part of the research for writing this book, and in Midtown Manhattan, for instance, you think of working class people as being fairly invisible. It's like Manhattan can feel like a pretty professional place, but when you go into the focus groups, there were, women truck drivers and secretaries, and just all of the regular people of New York City. It's also, who else does focus groups? A lot of people who aren't very average, like a lot of actors and performance artists do it to pick up extra cash, housewives, a lot of people that aren't really that big a part of the general population. So it's in some ways it is the average person that that the method is intended to represent, but in some ways it can be some pretty eccentric people as well. So people are recruited, generally speaking, to become part of a focus group, you have entered your name and your information into a database of a market research group, and they will call you when they have a focus group that fits, for which you might be a good fit. The people who are calling you are generally low wage workers. I mean, the recruiters are probably the lowest sort of the most poorly educated and the most poorly paid people in the market research industry, and they tend to be pretty desperate. Like, they're often under a lot of pressure to fill quotas, find people who fit these descriptions and fit these groups. So, for instance, like, if you, a thing that will happen, and people I interviewed who participate often in focus groups would laugh about this, and this often happened to me as well when I was attempting to get into focus groups. The recruiter will call you, and, you know, they'll ask you a question, you know, how often do you use paper plates? Do you ever use, when you use paper plates, do you use plain white paper plates? You know, and I had this experience once, and I would say, not really, because I'd be thinking about how usually I would buy them for a kid's birthday party, so they wouldn't be plain white paper plates. And the recruiter would say, yeah, but sometimes you would buy plain white paper plates, right? You know, and I would be like, yeah, sometimes, you know. And so like, the recruiter will sort of want to fill her quota, and she will then encourage you to stretch your answers, or stretch the truth, in order you can fill the criteria and get into the group. So often the person in the focus group and the recruiter are a bit complicit in making you into a person who suits the focus group.
And are people always paid for their participation in a focus group?
Most of the time, yes. So people are generally paid. You asked if people are, if there's an attempt to screen people out who are repeat focus group participants. Absolutely, yes. And this is a huge concern in the industry, and it has been a concern since the 90s, which is really when focus groups became so widespread in every industry, is the rise of the quote-unquote professional panelist or professional focus group participant, the person who participates repeatedly to try to make participating in focus groups a major source of her income. And a lot of market researchers will get very angry about this, because they feel it dilutes the authenticity of the focus group. The focus group is supposed to represent average people. They feel that there's something corrupt about these repeat participants, that they're lying about their qualifications to get into the focus group, so then why would they tell the truth once they're in them? There's a lot of anxiety. But interestingly, a lot of the anxiety is around the fact that these people are just doing it for the money, which is kind of interesting, because why is anybody doing their job in advertising or marketing? I mean, like, yeah, aren't they all also doing it for the money? So it's kind of a funny set of concerns, but there is a way in which the consumers are sort of supposed to generously offer their expertise and do their job of being average, and being paid for their expertise to the professionals.
What is the origin of the focus group? Where does it come out of?
So the focus group comes out of academic social science at Columbia University in the 1930s. There were a number of social scientists who were doing a lot of work with different kinds of qualitative methods to find out people's opinions on things, and it was a very entrepreneurial. It was a very entrepreneurial department, the Bureau of Applied Social Research, and they had contracts with industry, with media industry, and other consumer product industries, which was very unusual in academia at that time. Now we're sort of jaded that, you know, of course universities are doing all kinds of work for profit firms, but in that time it was pretty unusual, and they also had a lot of government contracts, and so they were working to test propaganda from the Roosevelt administration, trying to convince Americans to participate in, to embrace entry into World War II, which, contrary to what we think now, wasn't something that people were very eager to do. Americans had been pretty scarred by World War I, weren't eager for another major global conflict, and the administration was having trouble making its case. In the course of testing this propaganda from the government, from the what was then called the Office of War Information, the focus group was born. And it was super useful to the Roosevelt administration, because they found that the propaganda that they were using was too scary. They were really emphasizing the ferocious nature of the Nazis, their merciless tendency to be very cruel and sadistic to civilians. And Americans were like, no thanks, maybe we should just leave the Europeans to sort that out. And by listening to what people were saying, the Columbia researchers in focus groups, the Columbia researchers were able to discern that what people would respond to much better were more high-minded appeals to, you know, our democracy, our way of life. We're a more rational people. The Nazis are irrational. We can beat them. Then people needed to hear something more hopeful and feel that they were really part of something, building something positive.
Tell us more about the ideological or political places out of which the academics who helped shape the focus group came out of. What disciplines and what political orientation did they have, and how did that affect the form of the focus group and the agenda of the focus group?
Yeah, so the focus group really comes out of what we would now call sociology, but many of those social scientists were at that time called social psychologists. So there was a lot of slippage or a lot of fluidity between the terms like psychology and social psychology, and the social psychologists were often doing a mix of psychology and what we would now call sociology, and they came out of the leading researcher on this project was a scholar named Paul Lazarsfeld, and he came out of socialist Vienna. He came of age during what is now called Red Vienna, and was a very promising young socialist leader in the party. What was going on in Vienna at that time was, although Austria was run by conservatives for most of the country, the socialists came to power just in the city. So they were doing something that's pretty unusual and not often been successful, which was municipal socialism, having socialism in just one city, in a country that is surrounded by a government of a different kind. The socialists were elites. They came out of a professional class. They came out of cultural elite. They were psychoanalysts. They were scholars. Like lawyers, politicians. They were really they were a little bit out of touch with the working class people of Vienna, so a lot of their ideas were very, I mean, in addition to their economic ideas of redistribution and and public services for everybody and things which the working class was pretty fond of. They also had a lot of other ideas. They wanted the working class to be more cultured. They wanted people to listen to classical music instead of soap operas. They wanted people to not have sex outside of marriage, not drink too much, not have premarital sex, play a lot of team sports. And people weren't necessarily into all of those ideas. And so, as Paul Lazarsfeld would say years later, we needed to find out why our propaganda was unsuccessful, he said. And so the focus, so the Viennese socialist intellectuals at that time experimented with a lot of qualitative methods, and Lazarsfeld really became an expert in different kinds of qualitative research, and went on to to develop that more in Vienna, and when he came over to the United States, essentially as a political refugee after the right wing government and then the Nazis took over Vienna and Austria, because he was not only socialist but also Jewish. So he really he had to leave there and come to the United States, and at that point and so he continues these qualitative methods that that evolved out of that particular historical situation, but it evolves out of a moment of disconnect where elites have certain ideals. And certain messages, and the people at large are not hearing them, so they need to develop ways to listen and understand why, so he had already begun working on that problem as a socialist in Vienna, and then he continues working on that problem as a avid New Dealer in the United States context. I think that, and interestingly, I don't say enough about this in my book, but in the Labour Party in Britain is developing what we would now call focus groups at almost exactly the same time that Lazarsfeld and his Columbia team are working on this for the Roosevelt administration. There's something that there's something about social democracy that that really seems to inspire this, that where elites are like, okay, we have to make democracy work. We have to try to listen to the people. We have to figure out what they want. Of course, it then proves even more. It then proves even more adaptable as a method for consumer capitalism, which also requires people's participation in the sense of people have to be persuaded to buy stuff.
Indeed, and that is one of the threads that runs through your book, Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation, and that is that democracy and consumerism both need some form of participation from ordinary people within bounds, and so one sort of parallels the other, but in very, very complicated ways. I should say that this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm speaking with Liza Featherstone. I'm Sasha Lilly. So when you're talking about methods that were developed mid-century and earlier, coming out of the socialist tradition into the social democratic traditions around gathering information about popular opinion, how much do those allied into other ways of actually trying to shape public opinion and shape desires and so on?
Well, very much. They very much alighted because there were the focus group was one of many market research methods that were experimented with during this period. People were also, there was also a lot of public opinion polling, and there were depth interviews with individuals, and some of which even involved hypnosis and all kinds of much more intense psychologically intense strategies. But the focus group really proved an enduring one, because. Because in fact, people really do communicate a lot in conversation with one another, and people actually enjoy and will reveal quite a lot in groups.
To what degree did the focus group also have origins or drew on some of the ideas around psychoanalysis, and particularly that of bringing people together in groups rather than sort of one-on-one therapy?
So market research in general in this period is very influenced by psychoanalysis. And it helps that all these European scholars came over to the United States and who had been psychoanalytically trained. But it's interesting because what thrives in the United States is we think of in the 1950s Americans are completely in love with Freud. That's true, but what takes root in the United States is in mid-century is a bit of a different strain of Freudianism. While Freud is very Freud is rather pessimistic, the individual can really explore the unconscious and ultimately strive for what he called ordinary unhappiness. The Viennese researchers like Paul Lazarsfeld, and his former wife and student Herta Herzog, who also was really instrumental in developing focus group methods, they were really coming at, and also Ernest Dichter, who's a really famous market researcher in the same tradition, who was also a student of Paul Lazarsfeld. They're all coming out of a different tradition from a Viennese psychoanalyst named Adler, who was much more focused on getting the individual to adapt to society, and this proves very well suited to mid-century America, because that's exactly what the individual is being encouraged to do in mid-century America to a regime of consumer capitalism, in which you need people to buy stuff, you need people to a degree participate in democracy by voting, So these are the people who are going into market research and developing the focus group, and it proves an adaptable form of psychology. What's really then interesting is many psychologists in treating patients are starting to use group therapy in mid-century, that they're really discovering that people can often really work through social problems of adapting to society in groups, because the group can stand in for society in a very effective way. This method, this proves very interesting to market researchers who are already working on the focus group, and many psychologists honing their group therapy techniques treating patients realize they can make lots more money leading focus groups and take their craft to Madison Avenue. So we see, like, in this period, a lot of cross-pollination between psychology and market research, and a lot of professional crossover from academia into advertising, from psychology, from therapy into advertising. And it's also, it's a period in which people are really compelled by groups. Corporations are all sponsoring like sports leagues, you know, encouraging colleagues to go bowling with each other. There's like a lot of people are like joining groups in their communities. The 50s is often caricatured as a kind of a individualistic time, and we think of James Dean and, you know, just like these lone figures, but it's really not like that. I mean, people are very obsessed with groups and trying to fit in and trying to adapt. So when marketers really want to see how are people going to respond to our product, testing it in a group, and seeing how the group responds to each other and to it, turns out to be very fertile terrain.
So despite the fact that the ideas that led to the formation of the focus group come out of a socialist and social democratic place, the uses of the focus group and other marketing strategies shift very heavily to commercial purposes and right-wing purposes in the context, the political context of the Cold War. Can you talk about the importance of the consumer to the Cold War and how the focus group was important?
The Cold War is a really important player in this story, because the United States, American elites really have to convince ordinary people of a couple things. They need to convince them, you know, after World War II is over, they need to convince people who have been effectively socialized into making great sacrifices and living in a rather austere way. They need to convince people to then start consuming to get the economy moving, and so that's one persuasive challenge to which the focus group is marshaled. They also need to really make democracy very convincing, because to convince people that both in the United States and around the globe, they need to make both capitalism and democracy very convincing to show everyone that it's much better than communism. So part of the way to make that case is to show, you know, basically, we have such great stuff here. You can really live in a great way. You can have a shiny new refrigerator, and you can get to vote for your elected leaders, and you know, this is really a good system. And it's and communism puts some pressure on that, because it's you know it because it has a pretty good pitch. Like you could be free of worrying about poverty for the rest of your life. You know, like that's a pretty good, like, and you know, so that sounds pretty good to a lot of people around the world, and and the American elites have a different pitch that you know, you can instead have all these consumer goods and really lead a very comfortable life, and that it's just as egalitarian as communism, because these luxuries are so available to everyone, you know. So this comfortable way of life is so accessible. So what's so in order to do this, to make consumer capitalism work in the way that that they're arguing that it does, elites need to do a lot of listening about what people want in their consumer products, what kinds of advertising campaigns are going to convince them, what kinds of products are going to be desirable to them. So it's it turns out the Cold War really requires a massive amount of listening.
Journalist Liza Featherstone is my guest. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Liza Featherstone is the author of Divining Desire: Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's also the author of Selling Women Short, and she is a contributing editor at The Nation magazine. So although the focus group is extensively used in mid-century, it expands in the 1970s. And I wanted to ask you about that moment, because the quintessential consumer, as viewed through the lens of much of consumer capitalism, is the female consumer, the housewife, who's making decisions about what's bought in the home. And then, of course, in the 1970s, you see the rise of feminism, which is also about listening. So tell us about the gender angle in the story of focus groups.
Yeah. So all along, the focus group has been about listening to the ordinary person whose voice is not usually heard by the professionals, by the elites, by the policymakers, or by the people in the boardrooms. All along, that person has often been conceived of as a woman, and you know, part of that is that you know, while of course there's huge class differences in every historical situation between women, in this period, women aren't very central to they don't have a lot of power in the boardroom. There are not a lot of women in key policymaking circles. Even in advertising, you know, as you know, though women actually were a bit more represented in advertising than for instance we would understand from watching Mad Men, they're still pretty marginal in the industry. So a lot of the listening that has to be done is listening to women, and you know, so in the So we see that in the 50s, you know, long before the second wave feminism, we see that a lot of what the male researchers are trying to understand what the women are saying, that there's a lot of discussion of gender roles there, and you know, a lot of the discussion about market research in this period revolves around is the female consumer smart or sensible? Is she like are women greedy? Are they instead very fickle? And this sort of debate on the nature of women is common in debates over market research in this period. But as second wave feminism takes hold in the culture, for one thing, advertising is constantly criticized suddenly as being sexist, because there is a lot of stereotypical representation of women. Women are represented as being foolish, as only being housewives and not having other careers, other pursuits. As being, just easily placated or overexcited by consumer products. I mean, there's a lot of ridiculous stereotyping that goes on, and feminists are avidly criticizing it, and women are increasing, like ordinary women are increasingly put off by it as well. So there's definitely a sense in the 70s that advertising particularly needs to listen to women. There's also a way in which the habit of discussing things in groups becomes more and more a part of the culture. People are gathering in hippie culture. People are gathering in encounter groups to talk about their feelings, and it's even an important part of second wave feminism, consciousness raising groups, that people gather in groups to talk about the way that patriarchy oppresses them, and they're doing that for very political reasons, but the form, gathering in groups and talking about how we feel about things, is quite similar to the focus group, and in this period we become even more of a culture acclimated to those kinds of forms, to sitting around in groups and talking about how we feel. So the focus group just makes more and more sense and becomes more and more useful.
When did those involved in politics, in electoral politics, start turning to the focus group to try and divine the voting patterns of potential voters?
In the 70s, politicians begin using focus groups for that purpose. It is really in the 80s that it becomes pervasive, and in the 80s where you see market researchers, people who have made their careers on Madison Avenue selling things like Listerine, begin to start working for politicians and turn those same methods of listening to people and the same methods of tailoring messages to the groups they're listening to. That you start to see that really take off in the 80s, which is interesting because you see people really being listened to in so many myriad ways in this period, but at the same time, Reagan has become president, and the Reagan Revolution was really an attack on the ways in which ordinary people could exercise political power. For instance, Reagan shuts down the air traffic controllers strike in the early 80s. Deals a body blow to organized labor, which is really, and unions were really one of the main ways that ordinary people could exercise power over their own lives and over the system as a whole. So you see people really losing a lot of power, but their voices are being heard more than ever.
Liza Featherstone is my guest. We're talking about divining desire, focus groups, and the culture of consultation. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, we can see a lot of reasons why those on the left might be critical of focus groups, especially the ways that focus groups have been geared to help corporations sell things to the rest of us. But there's also a whole right-wing critique of focus groups that comes from people like the likes of Malcolm Gladwell. Tell us about the basis of the criticisms leveled by Gladwell and others.
It's so interesting because people just, people assume that criticism of focus groups would mainly be coming from the left because, you know, we on the left, like, we hate corporations, and, you know, we, you know, supposedly hate consumerism and advertising and things like that. And, you know, I absolutely found that criticism of the focus group it was much more pronounced in coming from people who were really either apologists for a neoliberal status quo or actually conservative. And Malcolm Gladwell falls into the category of the former. And he's really someone who's, you know, huge on the TED Talk, corporate speaking circuit, for his criticism of focus groups, and essentially what he always says is that focus groups are stupid because people don't really know what they think, people don't really know what they want, and the inspiring counter examples that he always gives to products that are so much better than those created by focus groups, the counter stories are always some genius entrepreneur who had a vision and just didn't listen to any of the market research and it worked out great. So it's really interesting to me because the message is always it's a very elitist message. The message is really just shut up and listen to the smart people, and I think that's really a message that the left should reject. I mean, you cannot have a mass movement or a populist or socialist society if you're essentially telling people to shut up and listen to the smart people. In interest and sort of so similarly to Malcolm Gladwell, we have and coming out of the same period, all these people, all these people's critiques come out of the 90s and the early 2000s, when focus groups have become such a fundamental part of the fabric of our political system and our consumer culture, our entertainment, just absolutely everything. So by this time, you hear critiques like Gladwell's, critiques like Gladwell's tend to lionize Gladwell and people like him tended to lionize people like Steve Jobs, who the Apple founder, who famously said would say focus groups that he doesn't use focus groups, and he was often really celebrated for that as being sort of a lone genius entrepreneur. The political counterpoint, okay, the political complement to that, tend to be conservative politicians. So George W. Bush, for example, famously said during all the protests in 2003 against the Iraq War, I don't govern by focus group. And what he meant was, I don't listen to the people. I don't listen to people who are telling me what they think about things. And it was interesting. And Daddy Bush, George H.W. Bush, was similarly really had a great hostility to focus groups, and you know would constantly say he didn't like them, didn't listen. It was very common on the right, but I think that in this period, what emerges is sort of a conservative, sometimes neoliberal, sometimes conservative, ideal of masculinity, which is like, you know, just like a guy who just really only listens to himself and really ostentatiously makes a big deal of how he doesn't listen to anyone else. And the focus group becomes kind of a scapegoat, becomes kind of a way to communicate that ideal. But it's really not a very inspiring vision, and in fact should give us pause. Like, what is so great about not listening to people? I mean, you know, sure, the focus group has often been used to sell us stuff we don't need, convince us of policies that aren't good for us, but you know, the impulse to listen to one another is a good one.
Sure, and it seems also that underlying all of this is a kind of a hostility to the unwashed masses who have, you know, bad taste and may influence things in a direction that dumbs down the culture. It's easy to lay that on the feet of the working class. So are focus groups now on the way out and the broader culture of consultation, or are we seeing it taking different forms?
Well, it's interesting because on the one hand, their death is always being declared. Their obituary is constantly being written in the business press, and by market researchers who are hawking some competing method, you know, which often turns out to be, you know, something really basic like crowdsourcing, or you know, something that is really, you know, we've been familiar with for some time. Its death is often being declared, but there's not much evidence that they're going away. People certainly seem to still use them. There's quite a bit of money still spent on qualitative methods, including focus groups. I mean, I think that the value of face-to-face conversation will probably, for elites who don't know what the people are thinking, is gonna, I think we're gonna see that for a long time. On the other hand, we're also seeing that the culture, what I call the culture of consultation, a culture in which we're listened to constantly, even though ordinary people have very little power, we've seen that expand absolutely exponentially with the internet. I mean, we are now participating. We're being heard all the time. Whenever we go on Twitter, we go on Facebook, you know, we write a Yelp review, you know, we're constantly letting the powers that be know what we think about things, and we're being heard and tracked in our every move and our every opinion. And in some ways, the internet does a better job of making us feel heard than the focus group. You know, its informality is kind of more fun. We can participate in it so much more easily. But on the other hand, the lack of control we have over the extent to which we're heard And the illusion that by giving voice we're actually doing something may in some ways be even more insidious.
Well, let me end by asking you, given, as you argue in the book, the widening gap between elites and the masses, and at the same time the way that politically, economically, people in the main are not being heard at all, but we're being tracked mercilessly as consumers. Do you think that there is a value to focus groups and the culture of consultation? How should we regard them from a radical perspective?
I do think there's a value to them. I think there's always going to be a need for people making one kind of decision to listen to other people who are affected by it. I think that the more horizontal our society is, the more egalitarian it is, and the more decision makers actually live among the people who are affected by their decisions, the less need there would be for things like focus groups. But I do think, you know, that the structure of facilitated conversation and the methods of listening will and should be always useful, that in that sense perhaps focus groups get a little bit of a bad rap, and I think we can I think that something positive we can certainly take from them on the left is the eagerness with which people do participate and want to be useful and want to think things through together, and I think that's something that we could make much better use of.
Liza Featherstone, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise, thank you so much, Sasha.
I've been speaking with the author of Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation. You can find a link to that book on againstthegrain.org. Liza Featherstone is also the author of Selling Women Short and False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Clinton. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.